the section we are in, which is Mark 6:14 to 8:26. We have just finished speaking about the leaven of the Pharisees, and we are on page 148 of the synopsis, Mark 8:22 to 26. A passage which is found in Mark only, significantly so in Mark. This is the account of the blind man who was healed at Bethsaida. The similarities between this account, Mark 8:22 to 26, and an earlier account, Mark 7:31 to 37, has been noted by some and taken as a doublet. You realize that the term doublet is used to refer to two similar accounts, and for certain people, certain critics, higher critics, this is a problematical matter. But it need not be so. Question? It's Mark 7, 31 to 37. The differences between this and the earlier account are significant enough on these grounds to regard them, the two accounts, as separate. In the earlier account, it was a deaf and dumb person. In this account, it was a blind person. So, I do not doubt for a moment that in the many miracles Jesus did, there must be some similarities. And I don't think that Jesus went about deliberately to heal people in different ways each time, or to say different things so that poor students who study the Gospels later on would not be confused. So there must be some similarities. Now, the term Ais Bethsaida, verse 22, needs to be, this term and the following word in verse 23, Comas, village, needs to be explained. Apparently, we are talking about a village called Bethsaida. But Bethsaida, in Christ's time, was not a village, it was a fairly large town. The difference between what is a village and what is a town really is somewhat subjective. However, we realize that we need to be more accurate in our description here. There was likely two Bethsaidas at the time of Christ. Now, some of your atlases would place a Bethsaida west of Capernaum and one east of Capernaum. Perhaps there might be justification for that, but I've not been able to find the west Bethsaida located in any reliable atlas. However, the east Bethsaida can be distinguished, as quite often happens, in the development of a town, between an older fishing village lying on the shores of the Sea of Galilee and a larger town inland, known as Bethsaida Julias, J-U-L-I-A-S. We assume that Jesus went to the older fishing village rather than to the larger town. So he and the disciples arrived, and we're told that a blind man was brought to him. We're not told by who. There seems to be a consistent attempt in Mark to de-emphasize certain aspects of a story. If you remember, in the case of the paralytic who was brought by four friends to Jesus, we do not know the identity of the friends. So Pharaoh Sin, verse 22, keeps the anonymity of these friends who brought the blind man. Now, the thing that is significant in this account is the use of the verb to see. Notice that there are four verbs which mean to see, each having a shade of difference from in meaning from the other. In verse 24, we read, verse 23, Jesus asking the blind man, "Eighty blepes, do you see anything?" Now, notice the idiomatic expression used. You're not familiar, I'm sure, with the "a" used in this sense in an interrogative fashion. Now, then you see the next word, anablepsas, looking up. Okay, there's a slight difference between this and the other. And he said, "Blepo, I see tus anthropus men hoti hos dendra oro peripatuntas, walking. I see men, but then hoti is it introduces indirect discourse. No, it originally introduces indirect discourse, but in this case, you have to translate. I see that they are, you know, I see men, then I see that, or rather, I perceive, horo, hoti, they are walking as trees. There are two words which are used here, blepo and horo. Blepo emphasizing broadly the function of the eye used in seeing. I see in the plainest sense. But horo emphasizing perception, not just the outward action of seeing, but what can be perceived through that scene. Okay, here was a case of a person who was having blurred vision. Now, in verse 25, Jesus laid hands on his eyes again, and we read, "The ablepsen," which means to look through and through, via with a blepo. Okay, I see here the compound verb where the preposition dia and blepo retain their original force. It's not always the case. He looked intensely, or he looked through. Okay, kai epekateste, and was restored. I'm sorry, I say Jesus looks intently, but it was the blind man, rather, here. He looked intently, and he was restored. And then we come across another word, kai eneblepsen. Here, a compounded form with en and blepo. The implication is that he could see into a thing. Now, as though you're trying to peer through something, and you're not able to see. But then your eyesight is restored and you could see into it. So, we have here a word which can also be translated as not just to see in, but as some translators put, to fix, to look at, or to fix one's gaze at something. Well, we have words here. Actually, there are five different words. I said four just now. We have blepo, we have anablepo, horao, diablepo, enblepo. When a Greek student looks at a passage like this, he rejoices because it is not only an easier passage to translate, but you begin to see maybe there's something significant about the use of the verbs of seeing. Now, I don't want to fall into the same trap as redaction critics who find symbolism in everything. But my question is, why does Mark tell the story in such a way? It would be interesting if we had parallel passages in the other Gospels. Unfortunately, we don't. And just to give you an idea how synoptic study can really help help you understand the motive of a writer. If, for instance, I'm hypothesizing now, Matthew and Luke told the story without the use of all these verbs of seeing, if they either left it out or just use blepo throughout, some interesting conclusions can be reached. Now, in this case, the story stands by itself. It is like a vignette by itself, where you can see a little incident. It stands by itself. It's actually a beautiful incident, like the story of Ruth, for instance. It's placed in a setting as a self-contained story, but with all the interesting aspects and the questions as well that it raises. Now, this leads me to say that I can perceive some motive in Mark's description of this account, which affects the rest of the passage, the section that we are in. And at this point, I will draw the synthesis now of this entire section, showing what I believe to be the inner logic of Mark in chapter 6, 14 to 8, 26. We see in this passage, if we can review quickly, that Jesus has conducted an extensive ministry. In his early, later Galilean ministries, and the unrecorded ministry in Mark of the Jerusalem visit, he made some travels, but perhaps in this section, his ministry outside Galilee, he had made the most extensive travels so far in his earthly career, using both the sea and land. He had gone to an area which was perhaps just as difficult to minister in as among Jews. But it was a very needy section of his ministry, because he was dealing in many cases with people who had no predisposition to Yahweh. We see the emphasis on perception of spiritual things, to put it generally, and perception of Jesus' mission, particular mission, and of his own person, to put it more specifically. There's a problem here of perception. Now, let me just say, I realize that I'm reading into the section some things, but you can judge whether this reading is reasonable, or does it amount to eisegesis. And that is what we want to avoid. No amount of exegesis can be completely exegesis. We have to I'm not justifying eisegesis, but we have to use sometimes certain ways of understanding to make what perhaps is not as plain to us, but which was very plain to the early readers of the Gospel, to make it clearer. And so, I think it is better for us to control the amount of eisegesis, keeping it as minimal as possible. And in a sense, I'm saying this because I realize that any use of presupposition in exegesis is tantamount to eisegesis. I hope you realize what I'm talking about. Okay? So, I'm seeing here a problem of perception, both on a general level of spiritual things and on a specific level, perception of Jesus' mission and person. The Pharisees asked for a sign. Well, they were spiritually blind, or as we would say in Singapore, they are gone case. It's just a slang term, you know, hopeless, spiritually blind. Herod was blatantly wrong. He thought Jesus was a resurrected John the Baptist. We can dismiss these two examples readily. The disciples, however, were not much better. Not much better. From the account of the walking on the water, we see that they were utterly astounded. That's the word that we use. They thought they saw a ghost. Okay, now, I'm not going to make too much of this ghost-seeing episode. But still, they, however we look at, however we interpret the ghost reference, we see that their perception of Jesus was faulty, was lacking. So, they needed teaching. And Jesus was concentrating now his efforts on trying to make his teaching more plain to these men before he was soon to leave the scene of his earthly ministry. By contrast, the Syrophoenician woman had spiritual insight. A person who didn't have the whole background of the teaching of the Torah, who grew up in a Gentilic atmosphere, yet her faith was strong. Perhaps Mark saw significance in this little incident, which to him was a stark difference against the backdrop of the imperception and the blindness that seemed to be prevalent. And so he puts the capstone on the passage by narrating a healing miracle that to him pointed to this fact in the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida. Now, I'm aware that others have taken this further than I have. I'm referring particularly to Keith Miller in his book, The Second Touch, about the second touch of Jesus. How he was a nominal churchgoer for a long time until the Lord had to break down everything, his own family life. He told very frankly his relationship with his wife, and then he received a new surge of spiritual revival in his heart. And that new surge, since those early days, had turned now into a full-blown charismatic experience. And he writes prolifically in this vein. So he sees, in a characteristic, charismatic way, I suppose now, that the second touch was a baptism of the Spirit, which to me, I don't want to digress too far, but to me the term baptism of the Spirit is sadly misunderstood. It is used in the scriptures. We have to understand it. But I do not see this as a second experience apart from regeneration. So, I don't want to go as far as saying, well, here we are. What this incident, the blind man at Bethsaida, means is a need for men to be revived through a second touch by Jesus. It could very well be that this is so, and I think many people do fall into lethargy and spiritual dryness, need to be touched again. But I will not want to derive that teaching from a passage like this. That would be, I think, reading too much into the double-stage healing process of the blind man. But generally speaking, I see that the purpose of Mark in this section might be to show, as he has done in the earlier passage, that the king has come, the king over God's kingdom, and that his message is given in the second section, far and wide, that men are able to hear it in large numbers, but in this section, to show that men do not perceive easily, and in fact they often misunderstand the message of to euangelion. And we are going to lead on to a new section where Jesus is pleasantly, I won't say surprised, pleased with a perception of his mission shown by Peter. Okay, we have some questions before I go on. Wally.
Why didn't Calvin put a double stage here? First, trying to understand what the second stage is. Second stage is the hard year. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there was some purpose there. Perhaps this man's faith, I'm now guessing. The problem is that I don't want all my statements to be regarded as equal weight. That's why I hate to make guesses, and without qualifying, because then it takes away the strength from my other observations, which I want to be very firm on. Well, I'm guessing that perhaps the man's faith was weak, and Jesus wanted strengthen his faith. Or perhaps it was I really don't know. I see that perhaps Jesus deliberately intended this man to experience a two-stage case of healing. But I'm pretty sure that whatever it was, it wasn't because Jesus' power was not strong enough, and something went wrong in the first stage, and he had to use remedial measures here. Okay. So finally, we have gone through another section, and we move on to my lecture 7. Chapter 8, 27 to 10, 52. And if you are numbering in the way that I've been recommending, then this would be Roman numeral 5, entitled The Way to Jerusalem and Ministry in Judea. Excuse me. The Way to Jerusalem and Ministry in Judea. This is the fourth major section of the book. It's Roman numeral 5 because I included the prologue as one. Now let's take some preview of this entire section. We are now into the second half of the Gospel of Mark. How do we know that? It may be a relative matter. Some people may mark the change somewhere else. But by common consent, and that doesn't necessarily mean it is right, the framework of the gospel account as given in Mark, which uses Peter's confession as the watershed of the account, is faithfully followed in all three the other gospels, even John. The framework of Mark is to show Jesus' ministry leading up to the point where Peter made his confession. There were Jesus was trying to build up teaching ministry, reinforcing it with his miracles and so forth. But from the you can say the confession of Peter, it seems the book of the Passion, as some people call the second half of Mark, begins. This is the point where Jesus now heads to Jerusalem, and he would not be deterred, even though others tried to stop him. He fixed his eyes intently, as it were, on the goal before him, marches right to it as an insect at night to a light, and he reaches that, he suffers on the cross, dies, rises from the dead. Now, some people might prefer to take the account of Lazarus' resurrection, raising from the dead, I mean, as a breaking point in the account. And there might be some reason for that, because we know that the chief priests and Pharisees began actively to plot Jesus' death after Lazarus was raised from the dead. But personally, I prefer locating the watershed point at Peter's confession, because Jesus' prediction of the Passion occurs en route to Jerusalem, and it appears that in his mind, anyway, he was already suffering. He speaks of his suffering in the aorist tense, and also of the resurrection. It is as though his mind was set, and what was to happen had already happened. So these are the reasons for seeing significance in Peter's confession. Now, yes, John?
So when you mention a frame of account, you're referring to Mark itself. That's what that means.
I'm referring to Mark as presumably the first gospel. Okay, and I perhaps will change my mind on the priority of Mark when I see an Aramaic Matthew, or when there is some other evidence other than papyrus. It's good enough, but I would need more. Convince me that there was an Aramaic Matthew, but I won't be dogmatic. But for the time being, we know we're dealing with the Greek Gospels, and from the Greek Gospels, it's quite clear that Mark was the first. So I'm assuming here that Peter's confession marked the midpoint of Mark's gospel, and that the other gospels, gospel writers, did not see the need to change that framework.
So four gospels.
Yes. Yes.
Did you say Peter's confession was the watershed of all four gospels?
No, it's the watershed of Jesus' career, earthly career, and that this pattern of describing Jesus' career up to the confession of Peter, and then extrapolating from that point to the Passion, is followed in all four Gospels. A significant thing to note about this section is that the teaching of Jesus is addressed to the disciples rather than to the crowds. You notice that very early on, after the early stage of the Great Galilean Ministry, Jesus began to concentrate on the disciples. It appeared that he was, quote-unquote, turned off from the crowds quite early. But this does not mean that Jesus was not concerned for the crowds. He had compassion on them. But he did not see that it was his duty during the remaining weeks of his earthly life to try and reach as many people as possible. You know, as though the more who would hear the gospel, the better it is. Jesus was more interested in, you can say, quality rather than quantity. Notice too that the journey that he undertook went all the way from the north, Caesarea Philippi, to Jerusalem. And if we take in the scheme given by John, it includes a side trip into the Transjordan area to Ephraim. Important groups of material in the Markan account are given at specific geographical points along this trip. Let me repeat what I've said. He went from Caesarea Philippi to Jerusalem. And it appears that Mark organizes material to take place at important geographical locations along this route. Let's note the following geographical locations. Mark 8:27. What happened at Caesarea Philippi? Starting point. Mark 9:30. They departed thence and passed through Galilee, and he would not that any man should know it. Okay? He went through, you can say, the side lanes of Galilee, rather than through the main towns. And the teaching that follows, from verse 31 and following, gives the extent of Jesus' teaching, I'm sure, as he and his disciples walked that long journey. I recall again the film Jesus. I saw that's the most the film that had most impact, I suppose, in my understanding of the gospel. How vividly they describe this journey, you know, as he and other pilgrims were chugging along. You know, the pilgrims had their horse carts and whatever it is, and as they were going along, there's a rich man in his beard, you know, and Jesus and the disciples walking, and he's putting his hand on the cart and talking to one another. He's asking questions, and they are replying. The pilgrims moving to observe the Passover, and they went around windy mountain roads, and as they rounded one curve, suddenly they saw at the corner three gibbets, and people were hanging there. The Roman method of execution for serious crimes. And when Jesus saw those things, he made his prediction of his passion. Now that seems to me a rather plausible setting why Jesus would introduce comments about his suffering, you know, when he sees displayed on the roadside pictures, these not pictures, but these real scenes of suffering. So, we have the teaching at this point, Mark 9:30. Now the next section is Mark 10:1. And he rose from thence and comes into the coast of Judea by the farther side of Jordan. Yes, he's drawing nearer now to the destination. And it appears that those who were traveling with him were not only common people, but also were the leaders, because we find the Pharisees disputing with him. Chapter 10, verse 32 is our next point, which reads, and they were in the way going up to Jerusalem. Now they had come within sight of the holy city. They could see the majestic temple. And as they were in the final lap of that journey, going up the slopes of that hill, you know, that would lead them eventually to the city set on the hill. Jesus went before them, and they were amazed, we are told. And as they followed, they were afraid. Notice their amazement and their fear. And he took the 12 and began to tell them what things should happen to him. Okay, so we have here the journey of Jesus now gathering momentum. But let's go back, shall we, and start with Mark 8:27-30 and see how this momentum builds up stage by stage. Page 149 of the synopsis, Peter's confession. Kelber takes issue with the use of the word confession. He feels that what would be a more accurate description here would be Peter's misunderstanding. And for this reason, Jesus called him Satan. And he took this to mean that that Peter was possessed by Satan, by a demon, or by Satan. Okay. Now, there is no problem here, because quite clearly we have a very human situation where sometimes a person who shows understanding is capable also of an incomplete understanding and acts more out of human impulses rather than spiritual insight. This is, I believe, what happened here. In this account, we have all the evidences that it is Peter's own story, except for one place where we will be discussing a little bit. One long section that is skipped by Mark and Luke, also John, but retained by Matthew. I'm referring to Matthew chapter 16, verses 17 to 19. If you look on page 150 of the synopsis, you can see the blank portions in the column on Mark and Luke, but the solid section in Matthew. Okay, apart from this, we can see that this account has Peter's touch in telling the story. It was his Christian confession, as well as a frank admission of his misunderstanding. I'm not referring to the Mark account, which does not have this admission as such. I've mentioned about Caesarea Philippi. No, I have not, sorry. But the first thing I'd like to note for you is the reference to Caesarea Philippi in verse 27. Notice that the word komas is used to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. A reference here more to the suburbs of Caesarea Philippi. It is difficult sometimes to know where the suburbs end and where the town begins. And so this is the way why Mark would describe that he went eis komas into the villages of Caesarea Philippi. Mark rarely gives place names, but he does here. Why? He's sometimes vague as to the time when an incident happens in those days, for instance. Or he sometimes is vague as to a place, and this thing happened without reference to a place at all. But here, in Peter's account, he is careful to pinpoint that it happened at Caesarea Philippi. Now, there were two Caesareas at the time of Jesus, one on the coast. And Philippu, or Philippi, is used to distinguish this Caesarea from the coastal one. Ancient travelers loved to speak about the beauty of Caesarea Philippi. Apparently, it was a popular resort area for travelers. And let me just give you an account of how travelers and historians describe this place. I'm not referring to the time of Christ now, but to now more modern times, which I believe will give a fairly accurate account of what Caesarea Philippi might have been like at the time of Christ. The coastal Caesarea was all the way on the Mediterranean coast, but here was Philippi to the north of Galilee. Now, a certain account speaks about the rush of waters through deep thickets, olive trees whose view over the distant plain describe it as a Syrian Tivoli. I don't know whether you're familiar with the term Tivoli. Scandinavians would understand this term. Another famous traveler, George Adam Smith, he has written the historical geography of the Holy Land, says, Panias, referring to a little town, lies scarcely an hour to the north of Tel El Kadi. From the latter you pass a well-watered meadow covered with trees, and then a broad terrace with oaks like an English park, till you come to the edge of a deep gorge through which there roars a headlong stream, half stifled by bush. In the cliff is a cavern. From the debris of boulders and shingle below, feet along a line of 30 feet, a full-born river. Well, Caesarea Philippi was some 25 miles north of Bethsaida, and it was a pleasant place within the reaches of, within the site, I mean, of Mount Hermon, whose peaks bring fresh into the region below, transforming it into a verdant pasture, and to what many people would describe as the bread basket of Palestine. The cooling influences of the dew from Mount Hermon was important for the crops that lay at the foot of this mountain. So you can get a rough idea of the natural beauty of Caesarea Philippi. Well, the account here does not highlight at all the natural beauty, but one can see why Jesus and his disciples would want to go to this place. They might have visited this place several times before. When Jesus went to Tyre and Sidon, he might have taken the ancient Roman road that went through Caesarea Philippi before one gets to Tyre and Sidon. But he might have taken another route as well, which would have taken him way out to the other side. However, what happened at Philippi was not so much a ministry that Jesus did there, but rather a conversation which he had with his disciples. In verse 29, he asks emphatically, who do men say that I am? I have to go back. He asks, who do men say that I am? And then in verse 29, he turns to the disciples and says, all right, it's good. He didn't say it's good, but so this is what people say that I am. he's not indicating that he was unaware of what people were saying about him. But then he turns and says, well, what do you say that I am? Okay. But before we get onto this, I want to look at the framework of 8:27 to 29. As I said earlier, when we were treating Mark 6:14 to 16, there is a similarity in the wording, in the formula. There was a question that is asked, and then we read, some say this, but others said that, and still others said something else. And then the question is just, but who do you say that I am? Okay, that seemed to be a kind of a framework there. Notice that the answer that was given, the threefold identification, John the Baptist, Elijah, or one of the prophets, highlight what appeared to the common mind, the prophetic ministry of Jesus. They took Jesus as one, as a prophet-like figure. We know that the prophets occasionally live rather austere lives with ascetic ways, and that they sometimes did miracles, and they spoke as though they were men. Well, they spoke as men of God, with their thus saith Yahweh. So the common people would readily identify Jesus in this way. But what is significant is that popular opinion seems not to have connected Jesus with the messianic Son of Man figure. Despite what Jesus said up to this stage, at certain points, as we have noted in our study of Mark, Jesus noted his role as the messianic Son of Man. But it appears that the Jews had not understood well what he was trying to say. Now, some might have explained that, well, quite naturally, he was in Galilee of the Gentiles, where devotion to the Torah was not as great as in Judea. Now, if Jesus had spoken those Son of Man sayings in Judea, he might not have got away with it. People would have readily made the connection. I don't want to press the distinction between Galilee and Judea too much. There might be a grain of truth in that. But still, I wouldn't blame popular opinion, because if their spiritual leaders, the Pharisees and the scribes, were blind as to the real identity of Jesus, not understanding either his words or his works, we can't blame the people for not understanding either what Jesus was or what he was trying to do. But it's significant that whatever messianic secret there might have been, there was obviously no great problem at this stage, because the names that were given by the disciples showed that the people had not taken him yet as the Messiah. Now we come to verse 29. I went ahead a little bit just now. And I want you to note here the emphatic position, the emphatic word, humes. But you, who do you say that I am? And notice, still in verse 29, Peter's reply, where he uses a singular, su, in an emphatic position also. You are the Christ. Okay, so there are some strong words being spoken here. Peter evidently recognized Jesus as the Messiah. Now, we need not take the words here to imply that Peter was the only one who recognized Jesus as such. We know that Peter was impetuous, that he was outspoken. Perhaps he spoke the minds of the others. Okay, there is no need to conclude from Peter's words that he was the only one, and therefore Jesus conferred on him the keys of the kingdom, elevating him above the rest. It appears that Jesus never established a hierarchy among his disciples, although he did take three disciples aside. I do not take this, however, as an indication that in position Jesus regarded them as over the rest. Nevertheless, let's look at Peter's words. He made the important identification, an outright identification now, between the human figure that he had been following and admiring, whom he partially understood but who attracted him no end. He made the identification between him and the long-awaited Messiah of Jewish expectation. The word Christos in the Septuagint was the equivalent of the Hebrew Mashiach. And one of the most important verses used by the early church to bring this out, and also intended by God to highlight the meaning of Mashiach, is the use of Psalm 2:7. Both Jews and Christians at the time of Christ took Psalm 2:7 to refer to the Davidic Messiah. It is true that in certain Jewish circles, particularly the apocalyptic segment of Judaism, the concept of a personal Messiah may have been not very clearly understood. The apocalyptists took this term somewhat corporately to refer to a leader who would bring about a whole group, and together perhaps they would fulfill the corporate role of the Son of Man. In other words, taking the idea of a corporate Christ, a corporate Messiah. Now, whatever it was, we are not entirely clear concerning the interplay between an individual Christ and a corporate Christ. But we know that the Jews at that time did expect someone to appear. It has been described as a person who would fulfill either in himself or more than one person to fulfill the tripartite role as a kingly Messiah, a prophetic Messiah, and a priestly Messiah. But we know that there was an expectation of a person who would who could be identified as the Messiah. Question.
Would you say that the Jewish world was expecting all three of these aspects of a Messiah in one person?
Not necessarily. Yes. In fact, when we speak about the Jewish expectation, we have to qualify ourselves, because we have to see that Judaism had not only its leaders. The rabbinic form of Judaism, of course, was the dominant form at Christ's time, but this does not necessarily mean that the people were sympathetic towards it. They were held by, they were in the stranglehold, you can say, of rabbinic Judaism. But there were large groups that stayed on the periphery, like the apocalyptists, like the Essenes, and others. But it's fair to say that rabbinic Judaism characterized the Jews at the time of Christ. But whether that Messiah was to come in to fulfill the three roles in one person or in three persons, that is not very clear. Well, I don't have the references offhand, but I believe with some effort I could locate where we can pinpoint Jewish opinion. It's much better for me to speak from some evidence, you know, some saying that is that it has been recorded, so we can actually say now this person expected this kind of Messiah, rather than speaking generally like that.
So, I mean, it's not even outlandish to say that possibly speaking from some kind of Messiah in three different roles, that means I've been totally out of line.
Yes, I'm not sure if that kind of opinion would be held by the majority of the Jews at the time. It may have been a minority opinion. So I didn't want to give the impression, you know, that this was the case. I'm sure in the popular mind, there was one person who fulfilled all the roles. However, you see that when Peter said, "You are the Christ," he meant something which he must have understood what he was saying. The words didn't just come out of his mouth like that. What exactly Peter meant by that may be debated. I mean, how much of an understanding of the fulfillment of messianic prophecies did Peter have in mind at that point, we don't know. But I think he had a fair grasp of things to be able to say these words knowledgeably. The interesting thing is to compare the synoptic renderings of this, and if you look across the page on page 150, you note that Mark simply says, "Sou eho Christos," you are the Messiah, you are the Christ. Luke is similar. He says, "Ton Christon tou theou," the Christ of God. "Tou theou" here is clearly subjective genitive, the Christ coming from God. John says, "Ho hagios tou theou," the Holy One of God. Okay, a different word that is used here, but quite likely the same figure, because the Messiah was also known as the Holy One, which raises an important question in our mind. What did what did Peter actually say at that time? Did he say, "You are the Christ," and then John misunderstood it and said, "Well, you are the Holy One of God"? Did Peter actually use the word Holy One? Okay, just hold this in abeyance. I don't agree, by the way, with the opinion that John misunderstood and forgot what he said, and so he just inserted Ho Hagios. Let's look at Matthew. Matthew has the longest identification. "You are the Christ," or Christos, "the Son of God, the Son of the Living God." Now, to ask ourselves, which of these is correct would be to ask the wrong question. In my understanding of the situation, the evangelists Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do not tell us all that Peter spoke, taken by themselves. You know, each of them taken by themselves. I don't think Peter just said those few words and then he was silent. And then Jesus replied. I'm sure Peter said more than just, "You are the Christ." He probably said, "You are the Christ, you are the Son of the Living God, and you are the Holy One of God." He said all of that in one outburst of affirmation. And each evangelist, therefore, records what stood out and what was relevant in their motive in writing the Gospel. So that's how I would explain the variations, you know. Lots of questions.
Could it be explained that he said something Aramaic or another language, which has a range of meaning in that language that can fairly be translated in several different ways in the Greek?
Yes, but that doesn't answer all the questions, because the Aramaic term for the Holy One of God would be different from the Son of the Living God. The variation is too wide. He probably said more than just what each one records.
Possibly say for John's account as a different
name. That's possible, but unlikely to me. I think I would like to think that Peter, having been told off once, didn't have to be told off again a second time. Okay, what's another question? Okay, now we deal with the question, why did Peter leave out the embarrassing, why did Mark leave out the embarrassing verses recorded in Matthew 16, 17 to 19? We can see why he might leave out I'm talking here now about the words here in which Jesus commended Peter for what he said and gave him further words, which are not to be misunderstood, incidentally. But this account is still, it stands by itself, because we see that Peter included Jesus' condemnation of him in 8:31-33 across the, sorry, in 8:33 particularly. But he left out this one. You would think that the reason would be that he would leave out 8:33, but would include 17 to 19. Well, I don't think we can get the full answer to this, except perhaps we say out of modesty. But I don't think we should use that argument too widely. It's too subjective. I think we have to just say we don't know why Mark would leave it out. I don't think Mark forgot what Peter said at this point, or rather what Jesus said to Peter at this point. But one would assume that when Peter tells the story, in his preaching especially, he would not want to play himself up too much, and quite likely he might not preach on these verses recorded in Matthew often, which may account for the omission here in Mark. But still, I want to make a point here because of the way these verses have been misunderstood. The powers, or rather the privileges that are given to Peter in verse 19 should not be taken as being exclusively given to Peter. It appears that Jesus Christ was saying these words to Peter representatively. Now in verse 19, Matthew 16:19, I'm trying to locate the words just a minute, he says, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven." Doso soi. Now it's true that the singular is used here, but in subsequent passage, which at the moment I'm not able to identify here, but we'll come to it in Matthew, Jesus spoke the same words to the rest of the disciples. They were not words meant exclusively for Peter. Yes, I've got the passage now. Matthew 18:18. If you look at Matthew 18:18, we read, "Amen lego humin, I say to you." Now the plural is used. "Hosa e ande sete, whatever things you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven." The dedemena, perfect verbal action, is important. "These shall have been bound." including the voice, the verbal action and the voice of Dedenena. It is not that they were given the authority to bind or to loose, but rather to declare what has been bound and what has been loosed, with reference to sins forgiven and sins retained. So the point I make is a comparison between Matthew 16:19, doso soi, the singular, to Peter, and Matthew 18:18, amin lego humin, the plural. Okay, I think at this point we can move on to verses 31 to 33. But let's take a short break before we continue. Begin, shall we? Yes, a final note on the Peter's confession. I ought to say that at the moment I'm still trying to see how John 6 fits into the rest of the passage, and it could possibly be that it refers to an earlier event, in which case we would have to revise a little bit of our understanding of this, of the second event. Why Peter didn't learn from his earlier event. It could have important implications. But at the moment, I don't have an answer yet. And I think the function of a teacher is to open up questions and lead you so that you can find some of the answers for yourselves on some of these matters. I want to move on to page 151 of your synopsis, Mark 8:31-33. We encounter here the first of what is to be three predictions of the Passion. Now, whether these were told in the vivid way that I described earlier, indicated in the film Jesus, actually seeing examples of crucifixions along the way, we cannot tell for sure. But it's significant to see that in verse 31, Jesus combines in an important way the two themes of the suffering servant of Isaiah 53 with that of the Son of Man. Now, we are told in Daniel 7:13 that the Son of Man will come in power in the clouds of heaven. The figure represented there is the figure of the exalted Son of Man, but not of a suffering Son of Man. Whatever this term meant messianically to the Jews, it was unlikely a suffering figure. So when Jesus linked the suffering servant theme with the Son of Man theme, he was doing something which was unique, you can say. If we compare the synoptics, we will see the high degree of correspondence, verbatim correspondence that we have here, showing that it was an important saying of Jesus remembered by these, I would say, not only in their Aramaic form, but remembered in their verbatim Greek form. If you compare, we see here that the phrase Son of Man is mentioned in Luke and Mark, though not in Matthew. That, of course, there are some differences. But the reference to suffering, polapathein, is repeated three times in the synoptics. Also, the reference to the elders and the chief priests, ton presbyteron kai achiereon, and to the scribes, kai grammaton, the next line, and be killed, apok tan thenai, and to the resurrection, age thenai, in Luke and Matthew, whereas Mark says anasthenai. And there's a difference Mark says, after 3 days, Matthew says, on the third day. There is sufficient correspondence here anyway to show us that quite likely this was an important saying of Jesus preserved in the early church. Some might say that it is difficult to describe this as a prediction of the passion, because in a few weeks' time Jesus would die. It might be easy for a person to predict what the weather will be like if he's in close proximity to that situation. It's difficult for you to predict what the weather will be like 20 years from now. Exactly. Be that as it may, I think Jesus Christ was clearly trying to point to his coming death by linking the prophetic verses. Whether he was making that prediction understood as such, we see that he was taking the predictions of the prophets, the Old Testament prophets, and linking them with his coming suffering. What is significant also in this account is verse 32, the phrase, Kai parisia ton logon elale. And he was saying, elale, the word plainly, parisia. This clause points to the decisiveness of the event. Jesus no longer spoke in riddles, parables as such, although he did use parables further on. Still, he speaks plainly now, but only to the disciples. And even after speaking plainly to the disciples, he charged them to keep it low-key. Now, in verse 32, after he spoke these words, we read, Peter proslabomenos. The word here, proslabomenos, implied that Jesus, or rather Peter, drew Jesus to him. Now, you can understand this either as a protective gesture. Peter just heard the Master say, I'm going to die, I'm going to suffer many things. And maybe he put his arms around Jesus or whatever. It was a protective gesture, saying, no, this won't happen, this won't ever happen to you, Jesus. Or as some commentators take it, I believe in a wrong way, as a patronizing gesture. And as though Jesus shook him off and saying, get thee behind me, Satan. Now, what really happened in this situation? I think we ought to try and reconstruct the situation. Because the words of Jesus to Peter in verse 33 were very stern. He said to Peter, speaking to him as though he would be to the satanic tempter in the wilderness, get behind me. Or you can paraphrase this by saying, withdraw, leave the scene, get lost. But of course, we won't use the word get lost. Jesus was speaking to Peter in much the same way as he spoke to Satan. Well, he was certainly stern to him, and the explanation is given, you are not on the side of God, but of men. And further, we want to see the importance of idon tous mathetas, turning and seeing his disciples. Now, why is it the plural his disciples is used? One would expect, and turning and seeing Peter, he rebuked him. The implication we get here is that he turned around And he saw the quizzical looks, you know, in the on the faces of all the disciples, as though not knowing what to do. When Jesus, Peter took him and began to rebuke him, that was, I think, what sparked off the stern words of Jesus. Peter took upon himself to rebuke the Master. Now, if we understand these words as in the plain sense, rebuke, then it would be something most discourteous, especially within an Oriental framework of thinking. The disciple had to be respectful to the Master, even if he disagreed with the Master. So whatever happened, we know that Jesus was provoked into saying what he did. And if I may again bring in Galatians 2, it seems that what happened when Paul had his encounter with Peter and was uptight was because Peter also made, it seems in that incident at Antioch, he made the aggressive situation first. He provoked the incident. You will notice that there was a remarkable change in the character of Peter after the resurrection. Although, as the incident at Antioch might indicate, there was some lingering problems there. But it's important in all of the discussion on this for us to see that Paul and Peter were always the best of friends and colleagues. There's no indication that there was any animosity between them. So we would disagree with F.C. Bauer of Tübingen, who makes a big point of the Peter and Paul disagreements. But here in Jesus' case here, we see that he spoke sternly to Peter without implying that he was actually possessed by Satan. He was using the term evidently in a metaphorical way, and also without implying that Peter was therefore to be condemned in any way. It was just that on that particular point, Peter tried to rebuke Jesus concerning the suffering concept of the Messiah. Jesus was trying to correct Peter, which tells us that his understanding of the Anointed One, the Messiah, was not a fully accurate one. He saw Jesus as Messiah, but he could not fit into that concept. I think Peter acted on his own impulse. He was not put up to it. Yes.
Is it possible that Peter, turning and seeing his disciples, he saw the same looks on their faces as he was seeing Peter's? Uh-huh. And so he's taken collectively, all of you. Mm-hmm. You know, this attitude.
Uh-huh. It could be, but the words were directed at Peter. If we look at the words themselves, okay, maybe it was a kind of a warning to the rest. If you also hold the same opinion as Peter, you are speaking not on the side of God. Obviously, Jesus had some thing that he wanted to convey to the rest of them, because we see the phrase "seeing the disciples." Okay, he had to deal with that situation because it could lead to a further misunderstanding. Okay, let's move on, shall we? Page 151 continues with further teachings by Jesus, and I'm going to skip all the way to 157, if I may. From sections 160 to 164, we have further teachings. We have the encounter. We have the section on the transfiguration. We have a healing miracle by Jesus. But I want to move on to the second prediction of the passion. I know this is not the best way to teach the course, but I have to make a decision now, and I want to deal with what I feel are the highlights of the point of the story here. I should really deal with the transfiguration incident, which is important in itself. Well, in the second prediction, let's note what happens. They are at Galilee now. The first prediction was at Caesarea Philippi. Okay, he was trying to maintain a certain degree of anonymity. It was difficult. And he was teaching his disciples, verse 31. Now the words that he actually says are found in the middle of a passage. Now you note what I said earlier, that Mark usually puts his sayings at the end of a passage. But here it seems he puts it in the middle, but it's quite near the end anyway. What he says in verse 31 is similar to the first prediction. In fact, not much change at all. And the comment in verse 32 that they did not understand the saying and they were afraid to ask reflects the situation at the time, that though he gave the first prediction, they didn't fully understand that. And after he gave the second prediction, they still didn't understand. But there was something about him that prevented them from asking. They were afraid. Perhaps their fear was due to his remonstrance at what Peter said. But there was clearly some tension that was going on, connected with the predictions of the Passion. Now, why didn't Jesus make plain? That is a question which we can ask. Why did he leave it to them to find the full force of the meaning of these predictions until after he rose from the dead? Remember that in the resurrection accounts we read, then they understood fully what he meant. Well, we see this as a method of Jesus' teaching. He did not always see the need to make things plain. It is sometimes necessary to keep a person puzzled so that it would provoke his thinking further. But I think there's more to it than just a teaching device. Sometimes I feel the answer, the best answer is a simple one, that it is not in the Holy Spirit's plan that one should understand something at a particular moment. And that could simply be the answer. That for some reason best known to God, one is to understand later on. If I may draw some pastoral observations from this, if I were to look at my sermon notebooks for the past 11 years, preaching to the same congregation, and quite likely I'll minister to the same congregation till I die. We don't candidate and move around in Singapore. We just stay put. That's the usual case anyway. I have preached many messages on prayer, and my prayer meeting is still poorly attended. I have preached messages on biblical separation, and I find I still have to preach further, even though some tell me that they are hearing what I'm saying over and over again till it becomes too familiar and it loses its meaning. I see the danger there. And on other topics, well, sometimes the fault is not in the preaching. I would like to think it that way. I believe the Holy Spirit helped me in answer to my prayers. And what I preached at a particular time was the best I could have done. The reason why the teaching didn't register is not because of any fault in the preaching. It could be better and more effective and all that, but it was plain. And the preaching also was, the thing didn't register, not because the people were dumb or stupid. I have an intelligent congregation. But in God's plan, the understanding of a certain spiritual truth was to come later. And this is His sovereign will for us. We have to accept it that way. And I have to remind myself, don't be discouraged. Because you can be really discouraged and think, well, you're not really seeing any results. I did one very foolish thing a few years ago. See, the time is going, but I just finish on this point. I gave an ultimatum to the church members and I said, well, if I don't see 200 of you out at the at the weekly prayer meeting, I'm leaving. I was tired of ministering to 5 to 10 persons at the weekly prayer meeting. I said, well, this is to a church of 400 members. And I said, well, surely, if you say that you really are going on with the Lord, you would also be mindful of prayer. Well, I got a lot of static and feedback. And, it taught me a lot of things, and I learned not to depend on numbers as a criterion of success. And I also learned from, especially from my study of the Gospels in this particular incident, that in God's sovereign will, He will open up the teaching to people at the right time. And we just have to faithfully preach and do our part. If the master teacher teaches without any results, and people still didn't understand, then I take comfort in that. But it does not mean, therefore, I don't attempt to try and do the very best I can. Okay, I hope you realize what I'm trying to say. Well, we move on. And I'm going to skip a whole section of verses, because we come... well, maybe before I skip, I'll tell you what I'm moving to. Very quickly, if you flip through the pages of the synopsis. After this incident, the prediction of the passion, we have the reference to the temple tax, payment of the temple tax, found in Matthew only now. Mark, page 158, has words to say about true greatness. Mark 9:33-37. 159, page 159, Mark 9:38-41, and a fascinating account of an exorcist, a strange exorcist. And there are some warnings given on page 160 concerning temptations, Mark 9:42-50. And then, interestingly, we have page 161 here, in Matthew and Luke only, a parable of the lost sheep. Mark does not have this parable. It seems the parabolic teaching of Jesus was severely reduced at this time. And from page 161 on, you notice that much of the material here are found in Matthew only, until we come to 164, where we have a large section from pages 164 to 205, an account of the last journey to Jerusalem according to Luke. Okay, Kurt Allen, in framing this synopsis, has put all the materials of Luke together. I think this is his way of trying to solve some of the problems of a harmony. I think it is a good device anyway, because it keeps the integrity of Luke without trying to throw out sections here and there. So you can follow all four Gospels systematically right through from beginning to end. And we have page 206, Jesus at the Feast of Tabernacles, according to John now. From 206 to 214, we have the ministry of Jesus in Jerusalem as recorded by John, again kept as an integral unit by itself. And on 215 now, we resume our treatment of Mark, page 215, section 251. Jesus has arrived in Judea. This is the next geographical location along that journey from Caesarea Philippi, and we take up the account from Mark 10:1. And he left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan. Okay, notice that Jesus didn't just go straight to Jerusalem. It seems that if he had gone down from Caesarea Philippi, he would have gone to Jerusalem without having to go across the Jordan River. But for some reason, he detoured and stayed around Judea. Maybe he had enough time. He had made good progress along the journey. And to enter Jerusalem too early would be to precipitate some of the final controversies he had with the leaders there. So he detoured a bit. And notice the emphasis on teaching in Mark 10:1. We read, Kai holds Aothe Palin Edidasken Autus. And as his custom was, now Edidasken can be taken as an inceptive, he began to teach them. Whenever the crowds came, he began to teach. You can say, put it that way. Or some might prefer just the plain linear sense of the imperfect, and he was teaching them. Whenever there was crowds, you will find him teaching. I think the inceptive imperfect fits the sense here better. I want to stop here and take it up from here on Monday. But let me just say very quickly that it's important for you to get a sense of the meaning of the verb here. When I refer to inceptive, imperfect, or constative aorist and so forth, this is how I approach a Greek verb. I see that there are basic tenses. For instance, I see that the important part of a Greek verb is not so much its time aspect, but its action aspect. That is the difference between the Greek verb and the English verb. Furthermore, I see that the regular meaning of the present and the imperfect, regular action of the present and imperfect is the continuous idea. And the regular action of the aorist and the future is the punctilia. And of the perfect tense is the punctilia linear idea. So it's quite normal to read the regular verbal action in, but where the context tells me that maybe there is something more than just the regular meaning, then I would turn to the list of special uses. And in this case, for instance, Eddie Duskin shows that the regular meaning is the linear sense. He was teaching. I won't say that this is wrong, but I prefer to see that there was something more to than just the linear sense. That perhaps what is being said by Mark here, whenever crowds gathered, he began to teach. So, to me, the inceptive imperfect carries the meaning very well. So I would argue for this special use based on both the context as well as what the verb itself can mean. Okay, and on Monday, I hope you realize that there will be a quiz. If you're not able to take it on Monday, let me know. Try to take it sometime later on the same day. Okay.